Our speaker this afternoon is Dave Ogden. He was educated at both the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He's an associate professor in the School of Communications at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Before coming to UNO in 2001, he was an associate professor at Wayne State College. Earlier, he was the director of public affairs at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dave's research focuses on baseball and culture. He has published work in a number of journals, including our own Great Plains Research, and co-edited the book Reconstructing Fame, Sport, Race, and Evolving Reputations. It's published by the University of Mississippi Press.
What I want to talk about today is some research I've been doing for the past 10 years. And what I want to talk about and show you is a phenomenon that's happening here on the Great Plains, but not only on the Great Plains, but throughout the United States. And that phenomenon is select baseball. And what I'm going to talk about is what I call the pipeline of baseball. In other words, what's the relationship, or is there a relationship, between this phenomenon that has grown over the past decade or so, known as select baseball, which I'll explain in just a little bit, and the higher levels of competitive play, and that includes professional baseball, the Major League Baseball. And then I want to talk about some reasons for what you're about to see and some possible explanations for the journey you're going to take through the pipeline today. So, and then of course I want to open it up to questions and anything you're interested in or anything related to this that you're interested in or have questions about. But first we're going to take a trip down the pipeline, what I call the pipeline of baseball. And that's from youth baseball to professional baseball. And we're going to start with where the pipeline empties. Whoop, did I do that right? There we go. And the pipeline empties, really, one of the places it empties for Major League Baseball is the first-year draft, which Major League Baseball holds every June. The amateur draft, in other words. And each year, for the past few years, approximately 1,500 players have been drafted. Two-thirds of those players during the past few years, or somewhere between 64 and 66%, are directly from the college ranks. Either from JUCOs, Division I, Division II, NAIA, all over the board. But about 66%, or about two-thirds, I should say, are college players. Most of the remainder come from high school and also from Latin American baseball academies and a few other scattered sources. So I want to talk about a chunk of the research that I do. And this is just one piece that you're going to see, and I'll try to wrap in some others as we go along. But for the past year and a half or so, a colleague of mine and I have been surveying college players. And basically, we sent out notices or letters and requests for participation to 70 universities, colleges, and junior colleges beginning in January 2007. 18 programs got back to us. About 500 players, 488 players responded. And these programs, as I say, represent all levels. In fact, there are the programs right there. So five of those schools are in the Big 12. And you'll notice three are from Nebraska, UNO, Wayne State College. Well, excuse me, two, UNO and Wayne State College. Of course, other locals, Iowa Western Community College. But those were the responding institutions or the responding college programs. So here's what we found. Who are the college players, or who are those individuals who enter the college ranks, and what's their baseball background? That's what we really want to know. What baseball backgrounds do they bring to the college ranks and subsequently to professional baseball? Well, 98% played high school ball all 4 years, and that was no surprise. 88% played select ball beginning at age 11. Now let me briefly explain what I mean by select baseball, as it differs from things like recreational baseball, league baseball, etc. Select baseball teams are characterized by this. Players are recruited via tryout, competitive tryout, via all-star selection from another league, or hand-picked for their already discovered abilities, by the coach or whoever's putting the team together. In other words, it's not a come one, come all type of thing. Just because you try out for a team doesn't mean you play. And these teams begin at, depending on the community, but I've seen select teams as young as 8 years old from other states. But on average, these college players, the 488 players from those programs, began playing at age 11. And basically, the age range was somewhere between 8 and 14 in terms of when they began. The 429 players who played in select ball played an average of 6 years in select ball and 45 games a year. 83% of the players lived with both biological parents who shelled out $918 annually for select ball. And what does that last figure tell you? Well, you can't say that the players came from a stable home necessarily, but you can say that there was a patriarch and matriarch in the family, so to speak, and that they could afford or shell out, on average, $918 to play select ball. That was all over the board, too, anywhere from $0 because for some select programs, they already have corporate sponsors or businesses that go in as a group to sponsor, or there's been a lot of fundraising beforehand. Some players reported that their parents paid as much as $5,000 a season for them to play. And that's not surprising if you've been around these types of programs or been to tournaments, et cetera. That's not too difficult to imagine. Some other characteristics. 57% of these players played other sports, primarily basketball and football, but 43% played only baseball. And players reported that on average, six of their fellow high school players also played select baseball. Now, 43% is not a majority, of course, but it's a pretty significant minority. And to think that 43% of these players played nothing but select baseball is not necessarily surprising when you really study what the industry around it is all about. But that's still a pretty hefty number who play only select baseball, i.e. specialization. Now here was the interesting part. What I wanted to know in this research, is there any evidence that select ball really does serve as a grooming period for players to play higher levels of competitive baseball? And one aspect of that may be, did they stick with the same position throughout? And in some cases, yes, it was very obvious. 96% of the college shortstops surveyed in this research played the same position in select ball. 93% of college catchers played that same position in select baseball, as did 84% of college pitchers. And there you see outfield, 61% of college outfielders we surveyed played the same in select ball, first base 58%, you see second and third base. Once again, right along those same lines, almost 82% of college shortstops played the same position both in not only select ball, but high school ball. Same for 80% of the college catchers. They played the same position in select and high school ball, as did 80% of the college pitchers. Once again, pretty much the same thing, parallel to the last slide you saw there. Where did all those other players migrate to then, who aren't playing the positions that they played in select and high school ball, primarily to pitching? Once again, not surprising. College teams, of course, like professional teams and other teams, carry many more pitchers than regular position players. So that would make sense. But you see there, in terms of percentage of select and high school players by position who became pitchers in college, 75%, and once again, pitcher, first base, outfield, third base. The only surprise there to me would be first base. First baseman, as was explained to me, however, one logical explanation may be these guys are generally taller, they're rangier, they aren't playing there because they have poor arms necessarily. And it shows right there, 60% of select ball first basemen became pitchers, as did 61%. But you see where shortstops pretty much stay shortstops and catchers stay catchers. That came through time and again. Catchers, select ball catchers, remain catchers. Shortstops pretty much remain shortstops. Pitchers, of course, pretty much remain pitchers. The others, not the case. So let's trace the pipeline back further now and basically try to discover where these players come from. As we know, they come from select baseball. But what you also have to figure in here, of course, is that once you reach that gate of college play, you are being primarily the better players, of course, are being recruited. And so this involves not only where these kids play, but who scouts and college coaches, or what scouts and college coaches pay attention to. And this is what they pay attention to. Select baseball tournaments, where there are tournaments throughout the United States where hundreds of teams gather to play for trophies, for the talking points, if you will, for pride, etc. If you've ever been, for example, to Cooperstown, New York, they have a Field of Dreams there, a huge complex where hundreds of teams pour in every summer. Omaha hosts one of the larger select tournaments during the College World Series with USSSA and can't think of the other organization, forgive me, but hundreds of teams, or at least a couple hundred, every summer pour through Omaha during the College World Series. And it's a good place to do this research. They've talked about building a Field of Dreams in Bellevue, Nebraska, which would draw in even hundreds more. And if you've ever been to these tournaments, they are spectacles. They really are. You see team buses, select teams having their own bus, mobile homes. Makes you step back and then take a deep breath and watch baseball. Many teams are no longer just teams. They're academies. They have facilities where players train 12 months out of the year. There's facilities here in Omaha, of course, and maybe in Lincoln, I don't know. But in Omaha, there's more than one facility where players can train 12 months out of the year. East Cobb Academy has its own facility, East Cobb, Georgia. The Roos, the Kangaroos of Chicago, Illinois, have their own indoor training facility. The ABC Bulldogs in Indiana have their own indoor training facility. The gentleman who started, Gerald Ford, not the president, but another Gerald Ford, had his own indoor facility in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and turned that humble facility into a national program called Perfect Game, which sponsors showcases in which the best teams, the best players are invited to display their skills before a national audience of college coaches and major league scouts. Area Code does the same thing. Team One does the same thing. The old days of the pro scout running around the back roads of America looking for that one phenom, those days are gone. Or they're certainly going away rapidly. They don't have to do that anymore. College coaches and pro scouts can go to just a few locations and see the best of the best without traveling to where they play. I just read a book called Perfect Game USA, in which that author claims that high school baseball, the relevancy of high school baseball, is quickly going away. Because you don't see the best players in high school baseball. The horses, or good players you see, often get pitched around, or they aren't thrown every day, or they get hurt throwing. These are the places that scouts and college coaches attend or pay attention to. Some coaches, according to one author, don't even go to these showcases. They just look on the websites to get the statistics, et cetera, and often base at least some of their coaching decisions or scouting decisions on that. So showcases, baseball academies are transforming the way kids get into college and subsequently pro baseball. And it's no longer scouts visiting every ballpark they can when they need to only visit a few showcases like this to see the best of the best. And as I'm going along, any questions or anything, dive in. My kids always did that. Now, let's talk about the difference between select ball and recreational baseball. Select ball, of course, without saying it's more serious, because I don't want to say it is, because kids who play rec ball are pretty serious about it too. But select ball definitely gives more exposure to any given player. On average, and this is some other research I did a couple of years ago, on average, select ball teams play 45 games per year, pretty much in line with what I discovered in this college research. But some programs, like the Ruse, like the ABC Bulldogs, et cetera, will play as many as 160 to 170 games a season. I've seen more than a handful of teams who play that many games a season. And it's just not in the Sun Belt either. It's just not in the Sun Belt. Recreational ball, and by recreational ball, I'm talking about City League ball, YMCA, other type of City League or City Recreation-based baseball, where kids will play, and I'm not putting those programs down by any means, no. As a matter of fact, more of those programs are needed. But kids play 15 to 20 games per year on average, and that's about it. They may play a little more if they hook up, of course, with a select team or they have an all-star tournament. But generally, 15 to 20 games per year. By the way, that also includes reviving baseball in the inner cities, which is a program sponsored by Major League Baseball and hosted by the Boys and Girls Clubs that have tried to develop youth baseball programs, mostly in the urban core, in the inner city. And they've been successful at doing that. They've had some, by their estimates, 200,000 kids go through those programs. But the whole purpose of that program was to increase the number of African Americans, or one of the purposes, not the whole purpose, but one of the purposes of RBI was to increase the percentage or number of African American players in the major leagues. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Select teams practice 4 months on average, according to the college research, the college players' research. Select teams practice on average about 4 months during the off season. That's all these kids are doing. Rec teams may practice 4 weeks, if that. Select teams generally have from 2 to 4 coaches. Some select teams literally have a whole staff. They'll have a secretary, a treasurer of the organization, especially academies. Some academies have full-time staff. When you look at the Chicago White Sox Academy, they have a full-time staff, which is a year-round sports academy, not just baseball. But select teams generally have from 2 to 4 coaches. Rec teams have 2 coaches at most. Select teams have a more complex organization usually because of the travel they do, because of the expenses, et cetera, et cetera. It can get more complicated than it should be. Now, who plays select baseball? This is probably the core of my research, and I'll show you the true core here. I have researched over the past 10 years 500 teams from 27 states, 500 select baseball teams. That means I've looked at more than 5,500 players, and these kids are between the ages of 11 and 14 years old. 98% of these teams are from the suburbs. I've seen just a handful from the inner city. And to be quite candid, they weren't very good. In fact, 2 teams I remember seeing were getting pummeled by what you could tell was a much more experienced suburban team. But the game is, in terms of youth baseball, the game has gone suburban. And there's explanations for that, which we'll get to. But very few inner city teams. And you don't see any RBI teams. Rural? No. Few. What rural kids play are usually with suburban teams. So, for instance, the Quad Cities Hitmen. Some of those kids are farm kids, but they play with a suburban team with a small suburb of Rock Island. I see rural farm kids playing, but it's most often with a suburban team. I did a paper a few years ago called It's Suburban and It's Serious about how youth baseball has really migrated away from the city, really, into the suburbs. And that's where it remains ensconced right now. This is what intrigued me. And this is really the core of my research. When it came to race, 89% of those 5,500 players were Caucasian. No surprise. 7% Latino-Hispanic, 3% African-American, less than 1% Asian. Now, when you look at the youth African-American population of communities from which these teams are drawn or which host these teams, where these teams are based, that figure is 9%. So there's something going on right there. When we're talking about 3% representation from communities that have a 9% of their population are African-American youth. And this intrigued me early on. In fact, really how I got captivated by this was following my son around who played select ball at an early age and noticing early on that I saw very few African-American kids on those fields. And that intrigued me. It surprised me. And I thought, well, as soon as I finish my dissertation, which was on another area of baseball, I'm going to look into this. And that was 10 years ago.
Just off the top of your head, do you know if, what the percentages are in Major League Baseball?
Yes, 8.2% for African Americans, 26% for Hispanics, and I've got that figure coming up here. I think 58, 60% Caucasian. Yeah, and we'll see that. Yeah. So when you look down the pipeline, what do you see? You're seeing a when it comes to African Americans, you're seeing a narrowing. Why so few African Americans? That for me is the Trump question. Do you have a question? No? I'm sorry, I thought you did. That's the Trump question for me. Why so few African Americans? Especially if you know the history of baseball and African Americans. Where a mere 50 years ago, there were still Negro League teams. Not many, because they were dying out. Officially, the last Negro League team, I think, expired in 59 or 60, the ABC Clowns, or Indianapolis ABCs. 50 years ago, well, we'll go back a little further. 60 years ago, between 60 and 70 years ago, Negro League Baseball was the largest business venture by African Americans in this country. 2 million African Americans attended games each year in the late 30s and early 40s. The Negro League's All-Star version, or their version of the All-Star game, the East-West game, would draw 50,000 fans to Comiskey Park every year. And if you've seen photos of these games, of these East-West games, almost all were African-American, dressed to the teeth because they just come from church. Many of them, as Buck O'Neill relates it. And this was central to them. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But that's, for me, the crystal question is why so few African-Americans playing at all levels? And by all levels, well, here's a comparison first. 76%, and this is from Richard Lapchick's Gender and Race Report Card, which he does out of Florida State University, DeVos Business Institute there. He's done this for years. He's tracked these percentages for years. But the latest that on his 2008 report card, 76% of NBA players are African Americans. 66% of NFL players are African Americans. 8.2% of Major League Baseball players are African American. This is probably the lowest it's been since the late 40s or maybe early 50s. And this number peaked mid-70s. To about 27-28%. But when you think of who those players were in the mid-70s, those African-American players, those were players who as kids followed the Negro Leaguers into Major League Baseball. In other words, they were first fans of Negro League players who became Major League players. And Gerald Early, who's a baseball scholar, African-American scholar, says that he posits that really after that, that's when you saw the interest in baseball by African Americans start to wane. The percent of players in MLB would support that. Because this has gone, in other words, from about 28% in the mid-70s to what we are now, 8.2%. When reviving baseball in the inner cities was started in 1989 by John Young, who was a former major league player because he didn't see any black kids playing, the whole purpose was to get inner city kids, including African American kids, playing. Now, when that program started in 1989, 17%, 18% of Major League players were African American. So we see that it hasn't had much effect on increasing the number of Major League players. It, of course, the percentage has been cut in half since then. So when you look at the pipeline as it pertains to African Americans, you see that at the end where it empties, the ultimate end, Major League Baseball, about 8.2% are African American. NCAA, Division I, the percentage of players in those programs who are African American is 6%. And that's held between 6 and 7% for the last 10 years. Back in the late 90s, it was 3%. And so what I thought spiked because I thought it would go back down, but it hasn't. It's remained right around 6% for the last several years. And then, of course, what I found in youth baseball, select team baseball, select team, not rec team baseball, because African-American kids do play the game, primarily rec baseball. And anybody who knows baseball knows that really to become proficient and efficient, you have to do it all the time. You have to touch the ball, as one coach says, all the time. And the more touches you have, the better you become. And it takes consistency in practice, knowing the game. It takes time to know the game. So kids who play 20 games a year compared to kids who play 80 or 90 or 100, even 45 or 50, would tell you that those kids who play select ball are probably going to know the game better, have the better skills, have the better opportunities also to play at those higher levels because they're at places where they get seen. Now, if we look at Caucasians, well, that's a little different. 92%. 92%, 89%, right around 90% of my youth ball, those 5,500 kids that I've looked at in youth ball, Caucasian, 80 in college, and I don't have the exact figure here with me, but you can see it's over 80% of NCAA Division I players being Caucasian, and of course in Major League Baseball, almost 60%. MLB players are Caucasian, so quite a difference, of course, when you look at that, drastic. So, what are some reasons why this is happening? Why have African Americans seem to have lost interest in baseball? Why the what I call cultural drift between African Americans and baseball? And I think there are a number of reasons. I always hear people blaming it on the cost of select team baseball, the economy, etc. And that may be one factor, but I think it is a factor, but it's not even a major factor. I think it's one of many factors. In fact, I did an interview with Jim Mudcat Grant. I don't know how many of you would know who I'm talking about, one of the most gracious men I've ever met. And when I told him what coaches were telling me, that they thought it was the cost of select baseball, he said hogwash. He said, you see kids wearing $200, $300 tennis shoes. They have the gear to play basketball and other sports, and it doesn't cost any more to play those than baseball. Well, it does to play select baseball. But if a kid wants to do it badly enough, sometimes they can find a way, sometimes they can't. But there are many reasons, I think, for the disparity between Caucasians playing the game, the number of Caucasians, and the number of African Americans, or just looking at the drop in African American participation and interest alone. And three general areas, intrapersonal, interpersonal, and social agents. And I'll just discuss these briefly. When it comes to intrapersonal, there are all sorts of theories, which basically say that children develop skills as their environment allows and as they're encouraged to do. Fisher's skill theory says children can't develop skills beyond what's accessible to them. You can't become a piano player without a piano. You can't become a ball player without a place to play, or without equipment, or without someone to teach you, generally speaking. Strauss and I, identity transformation and Bloomstein's ossification basically says that for anyone to develop a self-image or a self-perception, and depending on what you see yourself as, to see yourself as a ball player or other things takes experience over time. In other words, the more you do something, the more you learn, the more experiential learning you have, the more you know how to handle that particular role. Continuity of action, in other words, doing things day in, day out, tends to seep into your self-image. So you perceive yourself as being that. You perceive yourself as a ball player, if that's what you do all the time. You perceive yourself as someone who acts out certain roles. and does it on a continual basis. And this can fold into other theories, like self-development theory, which basically says that people envision themselves to be certain things, and their behavior goes along accordingly. That's one take on that. Giddens structuration theory says the same thing, that in order for people to to absorb certain roles into their self-image, they have to do it all the time. They have to do it all the time to be proficient. And the younger that this starts, the more ingrained it becomes. That's what gender constancy theory says. Kids really start associating, males start associating baseball with male roles and images as young as 7 years old. Some research has said even younger than that, which says something for starting kids early in baseball. One of the problems with RBI over the years has been that the funds were earmarked for kids 13 to 17. And when I talked to the MLB commissioner's PR guy, he says, well, that's the ages at which most kids drop out of sports. So that's why we focused just on that age group. Now, they have what's called the rookie program, which now focuses on kids as young as seven. But when I talked to them about the need to do that, this was 8 years ago. And they said at that time, we're really not worried about the number of African Americans in the game. When it gets to single digits, we will be. So maybe they are now, I don't know. Although 8.2, they could say is not a single digit. So, you know, Bud Selig can just make anything out of anything. He's, you know. But that's what that tells us. In other words, kids who start young, who adopt what are called routines, of playing sports or of certain behavior, and they do that over and over, it tends to seep into one's self-image. So when fathers want their kids to play ball and they think a game of catch every night's a good idea, it is a good idea. The kid may reject it later on, but if the kid buys into the program, it is a good idea. Yes, after they study. After they get the schoolwork done. Interpersonal reasons. African-American parents, Phillips research has shown this, African-American parents rank basketball as the most important sport for their children. Other studies have shown that coaches and school officials are more likely to encourage African-Americans to play basketball than they are Caucasian students. There's been two studies that showed that. African-American peer groups, there's been a lot of research done on this, put cultural stock in basketball. So when I hear from coaches, well, basketball is one of the main reasons why black kids don't play baseball, okay, that may be part of it, and here's the reason why, by the way, but basketball itself is not the reason why. It's what they learn and what they've been exposed to and what they've had an opportunity to do over the years. That's the reason, not basketball itself. And social agents, media, athletes and ads. Can anybody think of one Major League Baseball player who is a nationally known pitch man, so to speak? You see him on commercials, et cetera. But for athletic shoes, who do you usually see? Jimmy Rollins has become, Jimmy Rollins has been one of the rare ones who Major League Baseball is really trying to push as a role model. Good idea. They're about 20 years behind on this, but better late than never. What does media portray African Americans as? Often not very flattering portrayals. How often do you see them as physicians and lawyers or professionals? Not as often as, of course, you see Caucasians. What you do see African Americans doing all the time is playing sports on television. You see a lot of that. And if you watch sports, that's nothing new to you. But people like LeBron James, Allen Iverson, I mean, they've created iconships for themselves. I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes interview with LeBron James. I mean, here's a very young man who is in another stratosphere when it comes to promotion and public awareness. Community is another agent. In other words, back to Fisher's skills theory, et cetera, where do you find the prime baseball facilities? In inner city? No, you do not, unless RBI's build them there. You find them in the suburbs. In other words, the kids who grow up in the suburbs have more access to such facilities. Depending on family, of course, and that's another social agent, kids have the additional enabler of having someone take them there to use that facility, to encourage them to use that facility. Schools and institutions, channeling youth activities based on what is and what is not offered. And one of the first programs oftentimes that gets cut from athletics when the budget is in deep you-know-what is baseball, because it's never a cash cow. It's never a cash cow. You could go into the whole scholarship thing as well. And of course the paucity of baseball scholarships. But those are just some of the reasons. Those are what I call social agents. And when you add all those together, well, let me delve a little bit more into what we're talking about, routines. There's a theory that I've used to look at this called structuration theory. And not to bog down in academese, but structuration theory basically says that to repeat a set of behaviors, you have to have the resources and support to do that. Goes right back to these other theories. All these theories fold into pretty much the same mold. They just are described differently. But structuration theory says the same thing as those other theories do. To adopt a behavior, to adopt or to practice a set of skills, you have to have resources, support, some way to act that out. And when you can, you can then develop what Anthony Giddens, British sociologist Anthony Giddens, called routines. And routines are sets of behaviors, actions, interactions that you do all the time. You take them for granted. You do them so often. And they become a part, once again, of your self-image. They also give you, or provide for you, what Giddens calls ontological security. In other words, you're comfortable in your own skin. You're comfortable with what you do. You know you can be good at a certain activity or a certain set of skills, etc. But all that takes support. And some people are positioned to receive that support based on where they grew up, where they were born, and some people are not, based on the same things. So if you're born in the inner city or the urban core, are you going to have the opportunities and facilities kids in suburbia have? Probably not. Probably not. And that can create a huge difference in what you can and cannot do. During the heydays of the Negro Leagues, routines were built around, in the African-American culture, were built around baseball. And rather than to read that, to give you some examples, for instance, and Buck O'Neill tells this story, when the Monarchs were in, Kansas City Monarchs, a famous Negro League team, were in town to play one of the Chicago teams, the Page Fence Giants or something like that, or the East-West game was going on, churches in South Chicago would move their services up an hour or two to accommodate everybody going to the baseball game afterward. In other words, the routines of the African-American community were built around baseball. So the routines built around their church going were done so to support the routines of going to the baseball game. And that was part of the community. And that became an integral part of the community, not just in large cities like Chicago, but in small towns as well. And when you had people like Bill Bojangles, Lena Horne, other African-American luminaries owning teams, that gave it all the more cultural credence. When you had opinion leaders in the African-American community being part of the game, that gave it all the more cultural credence to African-Americans. Even in small towns, there's a little Buxton, Iowa. Anybody ever heard of Buxton, Iowa? A very small town in south central Iowa. It was a coal mining community, but had a large population of African Americans. And this was back in the 1910s and the 1920s. But the pride of the African American community, and ultimately at Buxton, was their African American traveling team called the Buxton Wonders. Once again, community routines would be based around following the Buxton Wonders. They'd hold church at different times to accommodate traveling to a town where their wonders were playing. They would make arrangements at work to get the day off so they could travel to Cedar Rapids to watch him play. In other words, routines were built around the routine of participating in baseball. Same with the Lucucci Nine Devils. What makes the Lucucci Nine Devils famous? Jim Mudcat Grant, that was the first team he played on. And he said the same thing. Lacouche, Florida was a small hamlet, a large population of African Americans, and they would pull up stakes and follow the team around. Baseball was the integral routine for that community. And of course, that's all changed. And it's ironic in the way it's changed too. I mean, when we talk about structures supporting each other, like the church going supporting baseball game going, you can have the opposite too. The Negro Leagues were really an important part of the ultimate integration of Major League Baseball. They were the farm teams for the integration of Major League Baseball. And without the Negro Leagues, people like Branch Rickey would have had fewer places to go or would have had a more difficult time of scouting these players and seeing them showcase their abilities. But because of the Negro Leagues, that really helped people like Rickey, who wanted to integrate, know who the best players were. The Negro Leagues wanted integration to take place too. In fact, the leading African-American writers of the day, like Wendell Smith, who wrote for the Pittsburgh Courier, was constantly writing columns, pleading and begging the Pittsburgh Pirates to give people like Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, Judy Johnson tryouts. And that's why the Pittsburgh Pirates are ready to lose their 17th straight season, because they didn't do that 100 years ago or 60 years ago. But Negro Leagues wanted to see that happen too. But ironically, when it did happen, it meant the death of the Negro Leagues. And if you study the new African-American newspapers in the late 40s, you see this transition, and rather quickly in 1947, where there were less inches and ink on Negro League teams, which occupied most of the sports page in the Courier, and a lot more on Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby. Actually, Robinson and Doby alone got more ink than all the Negro Leagues put together, all the Negro League teams put together after 1947. So this shift went from Negro League baseball, of course, to following those players into Major League Baseball. And that shift was the beginning of the end for the Negro League. So, and it follows right along with Giddens' structuration theory, where structures can end each other too. And so what happens is, as the Negro Leagues fade, all those routines build around those teams, shuffling times for other activities, et cetera, dissolved and went away. And when they went away, the whole core of culture, baseball culture in the African-American communities also went away. So when you want to talk about why African-Americans have gone from baseball to other sports, especially basketball, these are the reasons. And once again, this stuff's from leisure studies research, and you can just all put all these together in a big stew and really come out with some interesting stuff. But who are the enablers? Parents, authority figures, peers. Same with kids who play baseball. Those enablers or those individuals or figures are enablers. In other words, they encourage, they praise. They provide resources to carry out the activity, whether it be baseball or basketball. The mass media, same thing, frames or portrays what certain people should be. Research has shown that for decades. Access to facilities. That can be an enabler or a constraint. If you're in suburbia, that's an enabler if you want to play baseball. If you grew up like near 30th and Sprague, it's a constraint because there are no, there's one well taken care of manicured baseball stadium there, and that's in Fontenelle Park. Is it culturally sanctioned? And baseball has not been culturally sanctioned for compared to other sports and other activities for many decades. Constraints like lack of finances, mass media, access to facilities. These are all constraints for African-American kids who are interested or who would like to play baseball or who might play baseball given the chance or who would have the propensity. Other things too. Society expects African-Americans to be superior in basketball and is pretty convinced of that. If you really listen closely to commentary or read the literature, it's assumed that African Americans are going to succeed in basketball once they reach a certain level. Basketball, like jazz or hip hop, belongs to an African American whether she likes it or knows anything about it, or he or she likes it or knows anything about it, because it's culturally marked as black. In fact, Early said it's ironic that African Americans took a game in the midst, oftentimes, of urban squalor, they made it their own. And of course, Gerald Early is referring to basketball. Well, how can interest in baseball be increased? Not only actually for African Americans, but for any youth group. And sometimes I think that this is more driven by socioeconomic lines than racial lines. Because I think if you grow up in poverty in the urban core, in neighborhoods whose families are on the lower socioeconomic rungs, you face the same things. It just happens that more African Americans, I think, in the communities I study, are in that situation. Well, adding stability factors to youth environment. I've studied programs, too, that were very successful in interesting African-American kids and inner-city kids in baseball. One of them was called Elementary Baseball, done by John McCarthy, a former Baltimore Oriole pitcher in Washington, D.C., and he used baseball as a carrot on the end of a stick for kids who were in literacy programs, 8- and 9-year-olds. And if the kids did okay and got their lessons done in the literacy programs, they got to go out early and leave school early to go play baseball. It really added what he called a stability factor to their environment, because they didn't have any stable environment to go back into in inner city Washington. This gave them something stable that they could do after school. So I think that's one factor. Identifying community members, mentors, or what I've heard referred to as Pied Pipers. There was a gentleman, the late Herbert Moss in North Omaha, who really kept one inner city baseball league going almost single-handedly. But he spent all his time driving kids back and forth, shuttling kids here and there. But he was really a Pied Piper of baseball among kids in North Omaha. He encouraged them to play it. He would oversee practices. He'd oversee pickup games. He was around all the time doing that. And that's what neighborhoods need, a mentor, somebody who's going to be around not just over 20 games, but all the time, encouraging kids to play unorganized baseball or pickup games, which kids don't do by and large anymore. Providing instruction. Facilities aren't enough, and millions of dollars. Major League Baseball has thrown millions of dollars at this problem, and you see the result. It's not increased the number of African Americans in baseball. Indeed, the number has been cut in half. Providing infrastructure, and that means instruction, facilities, in other words, for lack of a better term, an academy of sorts. Not in structure or anything, but an organization or some type of support system that allows kids to express themselves through baseball. And starting kids early. The Western Hills Little League in Omaha has done a tremendous thing. They're a rec league, but they've opened their league to about 30 kids from Kellam Elementary School, mostly African-American kids. These kids are 10 and 11, and most of them had never picked up a glove or ball before, and they're way behind the others. So chances are, will they pick up on the game? Probably not, but at least they're getting exposed. That's better than nothing. It's better than that. So kudos to Western Hills Little League. But you have to start them at an early age. You can't expect a kid to pick up a glove and ball at 10 or 11 and try to catch up to kids who have been playing since they were in diapers. And believe me, some fathers have their kids hitting off a tee when they're in diapers. I tried it, and it worked pretty well as far as I was concerned. So here's my conclusions, or just some of them. I think that we're going to see a continual drop in the number of African Americans on MLB rosters based on who's coming up the pipeline. I think you're going to see an increase in the number of one sport baseball players. In other words, that 43% of players who play just baseball, I predict that will increase as the need for specialization and the drive towards specialization increases. And Little League and high school baseball will become less relevant for aspiring college and professional players. So those are just some of my conclusions. And there's Omaha at 3 a.m. Nice postcard there. But I'd like to entertain any questions or anything you've got to say, any issues, feedback. I look forward to it.